The Tale in Tales of Hearsay by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. The Tale, 1917. Outside the large single window, the crepuscular light was dying out slowly in a great square gleam without colour, framed rigidly in the gathering shades of the room. It was a long room. The irresistible tide of the night ran into the most distant part of it, where the whispering of a man's voice, passionately interrupted and passionately renewed, seemed to plead against the answering murmurs of infinite sadness. At last no answering murmur came. His movement, when he rose slowly from his knees by the side of the deep, shadowy couch, holding the shadowy suggestion of a reclining woman, revealed him tall under the low ceiling, and sombre all over, except for the crude discord of the white collar under the shape of his head, and the faint, minute spark of a brass button here and there on his uniform. He stood over her a moment, masculine and mysterious in his immobility, before he sat down on a chair nearby. He could see only the faint oval of her upturned face, and extended on her black dress, her pale hands, a moment before abandoned to his kisses, and now as if too weary to move. He dared not make a sound, shrinking as a man would do from the prosaic necessities of existence. As usual, it was the woman who had the courage. Her voice was heard first, almost conventional, while her being vibrated yet with conflicting emotions. "Tell me something," she said. The darkness hid his surprise, and then his smile. Had he not just said to her everything worth saying in the world, and that not for the first time? "What am I to tell you?" he asked, in a voice creditably steady. He was beginning to feel grateful to her for that something final in her tone which had eased the strain. "Why not tell me a tale?" "A tale?" He was really amazed. "Yes, why not?" These words came with a slight petulance, the hint of a loved woman's capricious will, which is capricious only because it feels itself to be a law, embarrassing sometimes, and always difficult to elude. "Why not?" he repeated, with a slightly mocking accent, as though he had been asked to give her the moon. But now he was feeling a little angry with her for that feminine mobility that slips out of an emotion as easily as out of a splendid gown. He heard her say, a little unsteadily, with a sort of fluttering intonation which made him think suddenly of a butterfly's flight, "You used to tell your simple and professional tales very well at one time, or well enough to interest me. You had a sort of art in the days before the war." "Really," he said with involuntary gloom. "But now, you see, the war is going on," he continued, in such a dead, equable tone that she felt a slight chill fall over her shoulders. And yet she persisted, for there's nothing more unswerving in the world than a woman's caprice. "It could be a tale not of this world," she explained. "You want a tale of the other, the better world?" he asked, with a matter-of-fact surprise. "You must evoke for that task those who have already gone there." "No, I don't mean that. I mean some other world. In the universe, not in heaven." "I am relieved, but you forget that I have only 5 days' leave." "Yes, and I have also taken a 5 days' leave from my duties." "I like that word." "What word?" "Duty." "It is horrible sometimes." "Oh, that's because you think it's narrow, but it isn't. It contains infinities and so on." "What is this jargon?" He disregarded the interjected scorn. "An infinity of absolution, for instance," he continued. "But as to this another world, who's going to look for it and for the tale that is in it?" "You," she said, with a strange, almost rough sweetness of assertion. He made a shadowy movement of assent in his chair, the irony of which not even the gathered darkness could render mysterious. "As you will. In that world, then, there was once upon a time a commanding officer and a Northman. Put in the capitals, please, because they had no other names. It was a world of seas and continents and islands." "Like the earth," she murmured bitterly. Yes, what else could you expect from sending a man made of our common tormented clay on a voyage of discovery? What else could he find? What else could you understand or care for, or feel the existence of, even? There was comedy in it, and slaughter. Always like the earth, she murmured, always. And since I could find in the universe only what was deeply rooted in the fibres of my being, there was love in it too, but we won't talk of that. No, we won't, she said, in a neutral tone which concealed perfectly her relief or her disappointment. Then, after a pause, she added, It's going to be a comic story. Well, he paused too. Yes, in a way, in a very grim way. It will be human, and, as you know, comedy is but a matter of the visual angle. And it won't be a noisy story. All the long guns in it will be dumb, as dumb as so many telescopes. Ah, there are guns in it, then. And may I ask, where? Afloat. You remember that the world of which we speak had its seas. A war was going on in it. It was a funny work, and terribly in earnest. Its war was being carried on over the land, over the water, under the water, up in the air, and even under the ground. And many young men in it, mostly in wardrooms and mess-rooms, used to say to each other, pardon the unparliamentary words, they used to say, It's a damned bad war, but it's better than no war at all. Sounds flippant, doesn't it? He heard a nervous, impatient sigh in the depths of the couch while he went on without a pause. And yet there is more in it than meets the eye. I mean more wisdom. Flippancy, like comedy, is but a matter of visual first impression. That world was not very wise, but there was in it a certain amount of common working sagacity. That, however, was mostly worked by the neutrals in diverse ways, public and private, which had to be watched, watched by acute minds and also by actual sharp eyes. They had to be very sharp indeed, too, I assure you. I can imagine, she murmured appreciatively. What is there that you can't imagine, he pronounced soberly. You have the world in you. But let us go back to our commanding officer, who, of course, commanded a ship of a sort. My tales, if often professional, as you remarked just now, have never been technical. So I'll just tell you that the ship was of a very ornamental sort once, with lots of grace and elegance and luxury about her. Yes, once. She was like a pretty woman who had suddenly put on a suit of sackcloth and stuck revolvers in her belt. But she floated lightly. She moved nimbly. She was quite good enough. That was the opinion of the commanding officer, said the voice from the couch. It was. He used to be sent out with her along certain coasts to see what he could see. Just that. And sometimes he had some preliminary information to help him, and sometimes he had not. And it was all one, really. It was about as useful as information trying to convey the locality and intentions of a cloud, of a phantom taking shape here and there and impossible to seize, would have been. It was in the early days of the war. What at first used to amaze the commanding officer was the unchanged face of the waters, with its familiar expression, neither more friendly nor more hostile. On fine days the sun strikes sparks upon the blue. Here and there a peaceful smudge of smoke hangs in the distance, and it is impossible to believe that the familiar clear horizon traces the limit of one great circular ambush. Yes, it is impossible to believe, till some day you see a ship not your own ship, that isn't so impressive, but some ship in company, blow up all of a sudden and plop under almost before you know what has happened to her. Then you begin to believe. Henceforth you go out for the work to see what you can see, and you keep on at it with the conviction that some day you will die from something you have not seen. One envies the soldiers at the end of the day, wiping the sweat and blood from their faces, counting the dead fallen to their hands, looking at the devastated fields, the torn earth that seems to suffer and bleed with them. One does, really. The final brutality of it, the taste of primitive passion, the ferocious frankness of the blow struck with one's hand, the direct call and the straight response. Well, the sea gave you nothing of that, and seemed to pretend that there was nothing the matter with the world. She interrupted, stirring a little. Oh, yes, sincerity, frankness, passion, three words of your gospel. Don't I know them? Think, isn't it ours, believed in common? He asked, anxiously, yet without expecting an answer, and went on at once. Such were the feelings of the commanding officer. When the night came trailing over the sea, hiding what looked like the hypocrisy of an old friend, it was a relief. The night blinds you frankly, and there are circumstances when the daylight may grow as odious to one as falsehood itself. Night is all right. At night, the commanding officer could let his thoughts get away. I won't tell you where. Somewhere where there was no choice but between truth and death. But thick weather, though it blinded one, brought no such relief. Mist is deceitful. The dead luminosity of the fog is irritating. It seems that you ought to see. One gloomy, nasty day, the ship was steaming along her beat in sight of a rocky, dangerous coast that stood out intensely black like an India ink drawing on grey paper. Presently, the second in command spoke to his chief. He thought he saw something on the water, to seaward. Small wreckage, perhaps. But there shouldn't be any wreckage here, sir, he remarked. No, said the commanding officer. The last reported submarine ships were sunk a long way to the westward, but one never knows. There may have been others since then not reported, nor seen, gone with all hands. That was how it began. The ship's course was altered to pass the object close, for it was necessary to have a good look at what one could see. Close, but without touching, for it was not advisable to come in contact with objects of any form whatever floating casually about. Close, but without stopping or even diminishing speed, for in those times it was not prudent to linger on any particular spot, even for a moment. I may tell you at once that the object was not dangerous in itself. No use in describing it. It may have been nothing more remarkable than, say, a barrel of a certain shape and colour, but it was significant. The smooth bow wave hove it up as if for a closer inspection. And then the ship, brought again to her course, turned her back on it with indifference, while 20 pairs of eyes on her deck stared in all directions, trying to see what they could see. The commanding officer and his second in command discussed the object with understanding. It appeared to them to be not so much a proof of the sagacity as of the activity of certain neutrals. This activity had in many cases taken the form of replenishing the stores of certain submarines at sea. This was generally believed, if not absolutely known. But the very nature of things in those early days pointed that way. The object, looked at closely and turned away from with apparent indifference, put it beyond doubt that something of the sort had been done somewhere in the neighbourhood. The object in itself was more than suspect, but the fact of its being left in evidence roused other suspicions. Was it the result of some deep and devilish purpose? As to that, all speculation soon appeared to be a vain thing. Finally, the two officers came to the conclusion that it was left there most likely by accident, complicated possibly by some unforeseen necessity, such perhaps as the sudden need to get away quickly from the spot or something of that kind. Their discussion had been carried on in curt, weighty phrases, separated by long, thoughtful silences. And all the time their eyes roamed about the horizon in an everlasting, almost mechanical effort of vigilance. The younger man summed up grimly. Well, it's evidence, that's what this is. Evidence of what we were pretty certain of before, and plain, too. And much good it will do to us, retorted the commanding officer. The parties are miles away. The submarine, devil only knows where, ready to kill, and the noble neutral slipping away to the eastward, ready to lie. The second in command laughed a little at the tone, but he guessed that the neutral wouldn't even have to lie very much. Fellows like that, unless caught in the very act, felt themselves pretty safe. They could afford to chuckle. That fellow was probably chuckling to himself. It's very possible he had been before at the game and didn't care a rap for the bit of evidence left behind. It was a game in which practice made one bold and successful, too. And again he laughed faintly. but his commanding officer was in revolt against the murderous stealthiness of methods and the atrocious callousness of complicities that seemed to taint the very source of men's deep emotions and noblest activities, to corrupt their imagination, which builds up the final conceptions of life and death. He suffered... The voice from the sofa interrupted the narrator. How well I can understand that in him. He bent forward slightly. Yes, I too. Everything should be open in love and war, open as the day, since both are the call of an ideal which it is so easy, so terribly easy, to degrade in the name of victory. He paused, then went on. I don't know that the commanding officer delved so deeply as that into his feelings, but he did suffer from them, a sort of disenchanted sadness. It is possible even that he suspected himself of folly. Man is various, but he had no time for much introspection, because from the southwest a wall of fog had advanced upon his ship. Great convolutions of vapours flew over, swirling about masts and funnel, which looked as if they were beginning to melt. Then they vanished. The ship was stopped, all sound ceased, and the very fog became motionless, growing denser and as if solid in its amazing dumb immobility. The men at their stations lost sight of each other. Footsteps sounded stealthy. Rare voices, impersonal and remote, died out without resonance. A blind white stillness took possession of the world. It looked too as if it would last for days. I don't mean to say that the fog did not vary a little in its density. Now and then it would thin out mysteriously, revealing to the men a more or less ghostly presentment of their ship. Several times the shadow of the coast itself swam darkly before their eyes through the fluctuating, opaque brightness of the great white cloud clinging to the water. Taking advantage of these moments, the ship had been moved cautiously nearer the shore. It was useless to remain out in such thick weather. Her officers knew every nook and cranny of the coast along their beat. They thought that she would be much better in a certain cove. It wasn't a large place, just ample room for a ship to swing at her anchor. She would have an easier time of it till the fog lifted up. Slowly, with infinite caution and patience, they crept closer and closer, seeing no more of the cliffs than an evanescent dark loom with a narrow border of angry foam at its foot. At the moment of anchoring, the fog was so thick that for all they could see, they might have been 1,000 miles out in the open sea. Yet the shelter of the land could be felt. There was a peculiar quality in the stillness of the air, very faint, very elusive. The wash of the ripple against the encircling land reached their ears with mysterious, sudden pauses. The anchor dropped. The leads were laid in. The commanding officer went below into his cabin. But he had not been there very long when a voice outside his door requested his presence on deck. He thought to himself, "What is it now?" He felt some impatience at being called out again to face the wearisome fog. He found that it had thinned again a little and had taken on a gloomy hue from the dark cliffs which had no form, no outline, but asserted themselves as a curtain of shadows all round the ship, except in one bright spot, which was the entrance from the open sea. Several officers were looking that way from the bridge. The second in command met him with the breathlessly whispered information that there was another ship in the cove. She has been made out by several pairs of eyes only a couple of minutes before. She was lying at anchor very near the entrance, a mere vague blot on the fog's brightness. And the commanding officer, by staring in the direction pointed out to him by eager hands, ended by distinguishing it at last himself. Indubitably, a vessel of some sort. "It's a wonder we didn't run slap into her when coming in," observed the second in command. "Send a boat on board before she vanishes," said the commanding officer. He surmised that this was a coaster. There could hardly be anything else. But another thought came into his head suddenly. "It is a wonder," he said to his second in command, who had rejoined him after sending the boat away. By that time both of them had been struck by the fact that the ship so suddenly discovered had not manifested her presence by ringing her bell. "We came in very quietly, that's true," concluded the younger officer, "but they must have heard our leadsman at least. We couldn't have passed him more than 50 yards off. the closest shave. They may even have made us out, since they were aware of something coming in. And the strange thing is that we never heard a sound from her. The fellows on board must have been holding their breath. "Aye," said the commanding officer thoughtfully. In due course the boarding boat returned, appearing suddenly alongside, as though she had burrowed her way under the fog. The officer in charge came up to make his report, but the commanding officer didn't give him time to begin. He cried from a distance, "Coaster, isn't she?" "No, sir, a stranger, a neutral," was the answer. "No, really? Well, tell us all about it. What is she doing here?" The young man stated then that he had been told a long and complicated story of engine troubles. But it was plausible enough from a strictly professional point of view, and it had had the usual features. Disablement, dangerous drifting along the shore, weather more or less thick for days, fear of a gale, ultimately a resolve to go in and anchor anywhere on the coast, and so on. Fairly plausible. "Engine still disabled?" inquired the commanding officer. "No, sir, she has steam on them." The commanding officer took his second aside. "By Jove," he said, "you were right. They were holding their breaths as we passed them. They were." But the second in command had his doubts now. "A fog like this does muffle small sounds, sir," he remarked. "And what could his object be, after all?" "To sneak out unnoticed," answered the commanding officer. "Then why didn't he? He might have done it, you know. Not exactly unnoticed, perhaps. I don't suppose he could have slipped his cable without making some noise. Still, in a minute or so he would have been lost to view, clean gone, before we had made him out fairly. Yet he didn't." They looked at each other. The commanding officer shook his head. Such suspicions as the one which had entered his head are not defended easily. He did not even state it openly. The boarding officer finished his report. The cargo of the ship was of a harmless and useful character. She was bound to an English port. Papers and everything in perfect order, nothing suspicious to be detected anywhere. Then, passing to the men, he reported the crew on deck as the usual lot. Engineers of the well-known type, and very full of their achievement in repairing the engines. The mate, surly. The master, rather a fine specimen of a Northman, civil enough, but appeared to have been drinking, seemed to be recovering from a regular bout of it. I told him I couldn't give him permission to proceed. He said he wouldn't dare to move his ship her own length out in such weather as this, permission or no permission. I left a man on board, though. Quite right. The commanding officer, after communing with his suspicions for a time, called his second aside. What if she were the very ship which had been feeding some infernal submarine or other, he said in an undertone. The other started, then, with conviction. She would get off scot-free. You couldn't prove it, sir. I want to look into it myself. From the report we've heard, I'm afraid you couldn't even make a case for reasonable suspicion, sir. I'll go on board, all the same. He had made up his mind. Curiosity is the great motive power of hatred and love. What did he expect to find? He could not have told anybody, not even himself. What he really expected to find there was the atmosphere of gratuitous treachery, which in his view nothing could excuse, for he thought that even a passion of unrighteousness for its own sake could not excuse that. But could he detect it, sniff it, taste it? Receive some mysterious communication which would turn his invincible suspicions into a certitude strong enough to provoke action with all its risks? The master met him on the after-deck, looming up in the fog amongst the blurred shapes of the usual ship's fittings. He was a robust Northman, bearded, and in the force of his age. A round leather cap fitted his head closely. His hands were rammed deep into the pockets of his short leather jacket. He kept them there while he explained that at sea he lived in the chart room, and led the way there, striding carelessly. Just before reaching the door under the bridge he staggered a little, recovered himself, flung it open and stood aside, leaning his shoulders as if involuntarily against the side of the house, and staring vaguely into the fog-filled space. But he followed the commanding officer at once, flung the door to, snapped on the electric light, and hastened to thrust his hands back into his pockets, as though afraid of being seized by them, either in friendship or in hostility. The place was stuffy and hot. The usual chart rack overhead was full, and the chart on the table was kept unrolled by an empty cup standing on a saucer half full of some spilt dark liquid. A slightly nibbled biscuit reposed on the chronometer case. There were two settees, and one of them had been made up into a bed with a pillow and some blankets, which were now very much tumbled. The Northman let himself fall on it, his hands still in his pockets. "Well, here I am," he said with a curious air of being surprised at the sound of his own voice. The commanding officer from the other settee observed the handsome, flushed face. Drops of fog hung on the yellow beard and moustaches of the Northman. The much darker eyebrows ran together in a puzzled frown, and suddenly he jumped up. "What I mean is that I don't know where I am. I really don't," he burst out with extreme earnestness. "Hang it all, I got turned around somehow. The fog has been after me for a week, more than a week, and then my engines broke down. I will tell you how it was." He burst out into loquacity. It was not hurried, but it was insistent. It was not continuous for all that. It was broken by the most queer, thoughtful pauses. Each of these pauses lasted no more than a couple of seconds, and each had the profundity of an endless meditation. When he began again, nothing betrayed in him the slightest consciousness of these intervals. There was the same fixed glance, the same unchanged earnestness of tone. He didn't know. Indeed, more than one of these pauses occurred in the middle of a sentence. The commanding officer listened to the tale. It struck him as more plausible than simple truth is in the habit of being. But that perhaps was prejudice. All the time the Northman was speaking, the commanding officer had been aware of an inward voice, a grave murmur in the depths of his own self, telling another tale, as if on purpose to keep alive in him his indignation and his anger with that baseness of greed or of mere outlook which lies often at the root of simple ideas. It was the story that had been already told to the boarding officer an hour or so before. The commanding officer nodded slightly at the Northman from time to time. The latter came to an end and turned his eyes away. He added, as an afterthought, "Wasn't it enough to drive a man out of his mind with worry? And it's my first voyage to this part, too, and the ship's my own. Your officer has seen the papers. She isn't much, as you can see for yourself, just an old cargo boat, bare living for my family." He raised a big arm to point at a row of photographs plastering the bulkhead. The movement was ponderous, as if the arm had been made of lead. The commanding officer said carelessly, "You'll be making a fortune yet for your family with this old ship." "Yes, if I don't lose her," said the Northman gloomily. "I mean, out of this war," added the commanding officer. The Northman stared at him in a curiously unseeing and at the same time interested manner, as only eyes of a particular blue shade can stare. "And you wouldn't be angry at it," he said, "would you? You are too much of a gentleman. We didn't bring this on you. And suppose we sat down and cried, what good would that be? Let those cry who made the trouble," he concluded with energy. "Time's money, you say. Well, this time is money. Oh, isn't it?" The commanding officer tried to keep under the feeling of immense disgust. He said to himself that it was unreasonable. Men were like that, moral cannibals feeding on each other's misfortunes. He said aloud, "You have made it perfectly plain how it is that you are here. Your logbook confirms you very minutely. Of course, a logbook may be corked, nothing easier." The Northman never moved a muscle. He was gazing at the floor. He seemed not to have heard. He raised his head after a while. "But you can't suspect me of anything," he muttered negligently. The commanding officer thought, why should he say this? Immediately afterwards, the man before him added, "My cargo is for an English port." His voice had turned husky for the moment. The commanding officer reflected, "That's true. There can be nothing. I can't suspect him. Yet why was he lying with steam up in this fog, and then, hearing us come in, why didn't he give some sign of life? Why? Could it be anything else but a guilty conscience? He could tell by the leadsman that this was a man of war." Yes, why? The commanding officer went on thinking. Suppose I ask him and then watch his face. He will betray himself in some way. It's perfectly plain that the fellow has been drinking. Yes, he has been drinking, but he'll have a lie ready all the same. The commanding officer was one of those men who are made morally and almost physically uncomfortable by the mere thought of having to beat down a lie. He shrank from the act in scorn and disgust, which were invincible because more temperamental than moral. So he went out on deck instead and had the crew mustered formally for his inspection. He found them very much what the report of the boarding officer had led him to expect, and from their answers to his questions he could discover no flaw in the logbook story. He dismissed them. His impression of them was a picked lot. Had been promised a fistful of money each if this came off. All slightly anxious, but not frightened. Not a single one of them likely to give the show away. They don't feel in danger of their life. They know England and English ways too well. He felt alarmed at catching himself thinking as if his vaguest suspicions were turning into a certitude. For indeed, there was no shadow of reason for his inferences. There was nothing to give away. He returned to the chart room. The Northman had lingered behind there, and something subtly different in his bearing, more bold in his blue, glassy stare, induced the commanding officer to conclude that the fellow had snatched at the opportunity to take another swig at the bottle he must have had concealed somewhere. He noticed, too, that the Northman, on meeting his eyes, put on an elaborately surprised expression. At least it seemed elaborated. Nothing could be trusted. And the Englishman felt himself, with astonishing conviction, faced by an enormous lie, solid like a wall, with no way round to get at the truth, whose ugly, murderous face he seemed to see peeping over at him with a cynical grin. "I dare say," he began suddenly, "you are wondering at my proceedings, though I am not detaining you, am I? You wouldn't dare to move in this fog." "I don't know where I am," the Northman ejaculated earnestly. "I really don't." He looked around as if the very chart-room fittings were strange to him. The commanding officer asked him whether he had not seen any unusual objects floating about while he was at sea. "Object? What object? We were groping blind in the fog for days." "We had a few clear intervals," said the commanding officer, "and I'll tell you what we have seen and the conclusion I've come to about it." He told him in a few words. He heard the sound of a sharp breath indrawn through closed teeth. The Northman, with his hand on the table, stood absolutely motionless and dumb. He stood as if thunderstruck. Then he produced a fatuous smile, or at least so it appeared to the commanding officer. Was this significant, or of no meaning whatever? He didn't know. He couldn't tell. All the truth had departed out of the world, as if drawn in, absorbed in this monstrous villainy this man was or was not guilty of. "Shooting's too good for people that conceive neutrality in this pretty way," remarked the commanding officer after a while. "Yes, yes, yes," the Northman assented hurriedly, then added an unexpected and dreamy voice, "perhaps." Was he pretending to be drunk, or only trying to appear sober? His glance was straight, but it was somewhat glazed. His lips outlined themselves firmly under his yellow moustache, but they twitched. Did they twitch? And why was he drooping like this in his attitude? "There's no perhaps about it," pronounced the commanding officer sternly. The Northman had straightened himself, and unexpectedly he looked stern too. "No, but what about the tempters? Better kill that lot off. There's about 4, 5, 6 million of them," he said grimly, but in a moment changed into a whining key. "But I had better hold my tongue. You have some suspicions." "No, I've no suspicions," declared the commanding officer. He never faltered. At that moment he had the certitude. The air of the chart room was thick with guilt and falsehood, braving the discovery, defying simple right, common decency, all humanity of feeling, every scruple of conduct. The Northman drew a long breath. "Well, we know that you English are gentlemen, but let us speak the truth. Why should we love you so very much? You haven't done anything to be loved. We don't love the other people, of course. They haven't done anything for that either. A fellow comes along with a bag of gold. I haven't been in Rotterdam my last voyage for nothing. You may be able to tell something interesting then to our people when you come into port, interjected the officer. I might, but you keep some people at your pay at Rotterdam. Let them report. I am a neutral, am I not? Have you ever seen a poor man on one side and a bag of gold on the other? Of course, I couldn't be tempted. I haven't the nerve for it. Really, I haven't. It's nothing to me. I am just talking openly for once. Yes, and I am listening to you, said the commanding officer quietly. The Northman leaned forward over the table. Now that I know you have no suspicions, I talk. You don't know what a poor man is. I do. I am poor myself. This old ship, she isn't much, and she is mortgaged too. Bare living, no more. Of course I wouldn't have the nerve. But a man who has nerve, see? The stuff he takes aboard looks like any other cargo. Packages, barrels, tins, copper tubes, what not. He doesn't see it work. It isn't real to him. But he sees the gold. That's real. Of course, nothing could induce me. I suffer from an internal disease. I would either go crazy from anxiety or take to drink or something. The risk is too great. Why, ruin. It should be death. The commanding officer got up after this curt declaration, which the other received with a hard stare, oddly combined with an uncertain smile. The officer's gorge rose at the atmosphere of murderous complicity which surrounded him, denser, more impenetrable, more acrid than the fog outside. "Is nothing to me," murmured the Northman, swaying visibly. "Of course not," assented the commanding officer, with a great effort to keep his voice calm and low. The certitude was strong within him. "But I'm going to clear all you fellows off this coast at once, and I will begin with you. You must leave in half an hour." By that time the officer was walking along the deck with that Northman at his elbow. "What, in this fog?" the latter cried out huskily. "Yes, you'll have to go in this fog." "But I don't know where I am. I really don't." The commanding officer turned round. A sort of fury possessed him. The eyes of the two men met. Those of the Northman expressed a profound amazement. "Oh, you don't know how to get out." The commanding officer spoke with composure, but his heart was beating with anger and dread. "I will give you your course. Steer south by east, half east, for about 4 miles, and then you will be clear to haul to the eastward for your port. The weather will clear up before very long." "Must I? What could induce me? I haven't the nerve." "And yet you must go, unless you want to." "I don't want to," panted the Northman. "I've enough of it." The commanding officer got over the side. The Northman remained still as if rooted to the deck. Before his boat reached his ship, the commanding officer heard the steamer beginning to pick up her anchor. Then, shadowy in the fog, she steamed out on the given course. "Yes," he said to his officers, "I let him go." The narrator bent forward towards the couch, where no movement betrayed the presence of a living person. "Listen," he said forcibly. "That course would lead the Northman straight into a deadly ledge of rock, and the commanding officer gave it to him. He steamed out, ran on it, and went down. So he had spoken the truth. He did not know where he was. But it proves nothing. Nothing either way. It may have been the only truth in all his story, and yet he seems to have been driven out by a menacing stare, nothing more." He abandoned all pretense. "Yes, I gave that course to him. It seemed to me a supreme test. I believe... No, I don't believe. I know. At the time I was certain. They all went down, and I don't know whether I have done stern retribution or murder, whether I have added to the corpses that litter the bed of the unreadable sea the body of men completely innocent or basely guilty. I don't know. I shall never know." He rose. The woman on the couch got up and threw her arms round his neck. Her eyes put two gleams in the deep shadow of the room. She knew his passion for truth, his horror of deceit, his humanity. "Oh, my poor, poor... I shall never know, he repeated sternly, disengaged himself, pressed her hands to his lips, and went out. End of the tale, 1917. The Black Mate, in Tales of Hearsay, by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. The Black Mate, 1884. A good many years ago, there were several ships loading at the Jetty, London Dock. I am speaking here of the 80s of the last century, of the time when London had plenty of fine ships in the docks, though not so many fine buildings in its streets. The ships at the Jetty were fine enough. They lay one behind the other, and the Sapphire, third from the end, was as good as the rest of them, and nothing more. Each ship at the Jetty had, of course, her chief officer on board. So had every other ship in dock. The policemen at the gates knew them all by sight, without being able to say at once, without thinking, to what ship any particular man belonged. As a matter of fact, the mates of the ships then lying in the London dock were like the majority of officers in the merchant service, a steady, hard-working, staunch, unromantic-looking set of men, belonging to various classes of society, but with a professional stamp obliterating the personal characteristics, which were not very marked, anyhow. This last was true of them all, with the exception of the mate of the Sapphire. Of him the policeman could not be in doubt. This one had a presence. He was noticeable to them in the street from a great distance, and when in the morning he strode down the jetty to his ship, the lumpers and the dock labourers, rolling the bales and trundling the cases of cargo on their hand trucks, would remark to each other, "Here's the Black Mate coming along." That was the name they gave him, being a gross lot who could have no appreciation of the man's dignified bearing, and to call him black was the superficial impressionism of the ignorant. Of course, Mr. Bunter, the mate of the Sapphire, was not black. He was no more black than you or I, and certainly as white as any chief mate of a ship in the whole of the Port of London. His complexion was of a sort that did not take the tan easily, and I happened to know that the poor fellow had had a month's illness just before he joined the Sapphire. From this you will perceive that I knew Bunter. Of course I knew him. And what's more, I knew his secret at the time, this secret which... never mind just now. Returning to Bunter's personal appearance, it was nothing but ignorant prejudice on the part of the foreman stevedore to say, as he did in my hearing, "I bet he's a foreigner of some sort." A man may have black hair without being set down for a Dago. I've known a West Country sailor, bosun of a fine ship, who looked more Spanish than any Spaniard afloat I've ever met. He looked like a Spaniard in a picture. Competent authorities tell us that this earth is to be finally the inheritance of men with dark hair and brown eyes. It seems that already the great majority of mankind is dark-haired in various shades. But it is only when you meet one that you notice how men with really black hair, black as ebony, are rare. Bunter's hair was absolutely black, black as a raven's wing. He wore, too, all his beard, clipped but a good length all the same, and his eyebrows were thick and bushy. Add to this steely blue eyes, which in a fair-haired man would have been nothing so extraordinary, but in that sombre framing made a startling contrast, and you will easily understand that Bunter was noticeable enough. If it had not been for the quietness of his movements, for the general soberness of his demeanour, one would have given him credit for a fiercely passionate nature. Of course, he was not in his first youth, but if the expression, "in the force of his age," has any meaning, he realised it completely. He was a tall man too, though rather spare. Seeing him from his poop indefatigably busy with his duties, Captain Ashton, of the clipper ship Elsinore, lying just ahead of the Sapphire, remarked once to a friend that "Johns has got somebody there to hustle his ship along for him." Captain Johns, master of the Sapphire, having commanded ships for many years, was well known without being much respected or liked. In the company of his fellows he was either neglected or chaffed. The chaffing was generally undertaken by Captain Ashton, a cynical and teasing sort of man. It was Captain Ashton who permitted himself the unpleasant joke of proclaiming once in company that Johns is of the opinion that every sailor above 40 years of age ought to be poisoned, shipmasters in actual command excepted. It was in a city restaurant where several well-known shipmasters were having lunch together. There was Captain Ashton, florid and jovial, in a large white waistcoat and with a yellow rose in his buttonhole. Captain Sellers in a sack coat, thin and pale-faced, with his iron-grey hair tucked behind his ears and, but for the absence of spectacles, looking like an ascetical mild man of books. Captain Hell, a bluff sea-dog with hairy fingers, in blue serge and a black felt hat pushed far back off his crimson forehead. There was also a very young shipmaster with a little fair moustache and serious eyes, who said nothing and only smiled faintly from time to time. Captain Johns, very much startled, raised his perplexed and credulous glance, which, together with a low and horizontally wrinkled brow, did not make a very intellectual ensemble. This impression was by no means mended by the slightly pointed form of his bald head. Everybody laughed outright, and thus guided, Captain Johns ended by smiling rather sourly and attempted to defend himself. It was all very well to joke, but nowadays, when ships, to pay anything at all, had to be driven hard on the passage and in harbour, the sea was no place for elderly men. Only young men and men in their prime were equal to modern conditions of push and hurry. Look at the great firms. Almost every single one of them was getting rid of men showing any signs of age. He, for one, didn't want any oldsters on board his ship. And indeed, in this opinion, Captain Johns was not singular. There was, at that time, a lot of seamen with nothing against them but that they were grizzled, wearing out the soles of their last pair of boots on the pavement of the city in the heartbreaking search for a berth. Captain Johns added, with a sort of ill-humoured innocence, that from holding that opinion to thinking of poisoning people was a very long step. This seemed final, but Captain Ashton would not let go his joke. "Oh, yes, I'm sure you would. You said distinctly, 'Of no use.' What's to be done with men who are of no use? You're a kind-hearted fellow, Johns. I'm sure that if only you thought it over carefully, you would consent to have them poisoned in some painless manner." Captain Sellers twitched his thin, sinuous lips. "Make ghosts of them," he suggested pointedly. At the mention of ghosts, Captain Johns became shy in his perplexed, sly, and unlovely manner. Captain Ashton winked. "Yes, and then perhaps you would get a chance to have a communication with the world of spirits. Surely the ghosts of seamen should haunt ships. Some of them would be sure to call on an old shipmate." Captain Sellers remarked dryly, "Don't raise his hopes like this. It's cruel. He won't see anything. You know, Johns, that nobody has ever seen a ghost." At this intolerable provocation, Captain Johns came out of his reserve. With no perplexity whatever, but with a positive passion of credulity giving momentary lustre to his dull little eyes, he brought up a lot of authenticated instances. There were books and books full of instances. It was merest ignorance to deny supernatural apparitions. Cases were published every month in a special newspaper. Professor Cranks saw ghosts daily, and Professor Cranks was no small potatoes either, one of the biggest scientific men living. And there was that newspaper fellow, what's his name, who had a girl ghost visitor. He printed in his papers things she said to him, and to say there were no ghosts after that. Why, they've been photographed. What more proof do you want?" Captain Johns was indignant. Captain Bell's lips twitched, but Captain Ashton protested now. "For goodness sake, don't keep him going with that. And by the by, Johns, who's that hairy pirate you've got for your new mate? Nobody in the dock seems to have seen him before." Captain Johns, pacified by the change of subjects, answered simply that Willie, the tobacconist at the corner of Fenchurch Street, had sent him along. Willie, his shop, and the very house in Fenchurch Street, I believe, are gone now. In his time, wearing a careworn, absent-minded look on his pasty face, Willie served with tobacco many southern-going ships out of the port of London. At certain times of the day the shop would be full of shipmasters. They sat on casks, they lounged against the counter. Many a youngster found his first lift in life there. Many a man got a sorely needed berth by simply dropping in for 4 pennyworth of bird's eye at an auspicious moment. Even Willie's assistant, a red-headed, uninterested, delicate-looking young fellow, would hand you across the counter sometimes a bit of valuable intelligence with your box of cigarettes, in a whisper, lips hardly moving. Thus, the Belladonna, South Dock, second officer wanted. You may be in time for it if you hurry up. And didn't one just fly? "Oh, Willie sent him," said Captain Ashton. "He's a very striking man. If you were to put a red sash round his waist and a red handkerchief round his head, he would look exactly like one of them buccaneering chaps that made men walk the plank and carried women off into captivity. Look out, Johns, he don't cut your throat for you and run off with the sapphire. What ship has he come out of last?" Captain Johns, after looking up credulously as usual, wrinkled his brow and said placidly that the man had seen better days. His name was Bunter. He's had command of a Liverpool ship, the Samaria, some years ago. He lost her in the Indian Ocean and had his certificate suspended for a year. Ever since then he's not been able to get another command. He's been knocking about in the Western Ocean trade lately. That accounts for him being a stranger to everybody about the docks, Captain Ashton concluded as they rose from table. Captain Johns walked down to the dock after lunch. He was short of stature and slightly bandy. His appearance did not inspire the generality of mankind with esteem, but it must have been otherwise with his employers. He had the reputation of being an uncomfortable commander, meticulous in trifles, always nursing a grievance of some sort, and incessantly nagging. He was not a man to kick up a row with you and be done with it, but to say nasty things in a whining voice, a man capable of making one's life a perfect misery if he took a dislike to an officer. That very evening I went to see Bunter on board and sympathised with him on his prospects for the voyage. He was subdued. I suppose a man with a secret locked up in his breast loses his buoyancy. And there was another reason why I could not expect Bunter to show a great elasticity of spirit. For one thing, he had been very seedy lately, and besides—but of that later. Captain Johns had been on board that afternoon and had loitered and dodged about his chief mate in a manner which had annoyed Bunter exceedingly. "What could he mean?" he asked with calm exasperation. "One would think he suspected I had stolen something and tried to see in what pocket I had stowed it away, or that somebody told him I had a tail and he wanted to find out how I managed to conceal it. I don't like to be approached from behind several times in one afternoon in that creepy way, and then to be looked up at suddenly in front from under my elbow. Is it a new sort of peepo game? It doesn't amuse me. I'm no longer a baby." I assured him that if anyone were to tell Captain Johns that he, Bunter, had a tail, Johns would manage to get himself to believe the story in some mysterious manner. He would. He was suspicious and credulous to an inconceivable degree. He would believe any silly tale, suspect any man of anything, and crawl about with it and ruminate the stuff, and turn it over and over in his mind in the most miserable, inwardly whining perplexity. He would take the meanest possible view in the end, and discover the meanest possible course of action by a sort of natural genius for that sort of thing. Bunter also told me that the mean creature had crept all over the ship on his little bandy legs, taking him along to grumble and whine to about a lot of trifles. Crept about the docks like a wretched insect, like a cockroach, only not so lively. Thus did the self-possessed Bunter express himself with great disgust. Then, going on with his usual stately deliberation, made sinister by the frown of his jet-black eyebrows, "And the fellow is mad, too. He tried to be sociable for a bit, and could find nothing else but to make big eyes at me, and ask me if I believed in communications beyond the grave." Communications beyond? I didn't know what he meant at first. I didn't know what to say. "A very solemn subject, Mr. Bunter," says he. "I've given a great deal of study to it." Had Johns lived on shore, he would have been the predestined prey of fraudulent mediums, or even if he had had any decent opportunities between the voyages. Luckily for him, when in England, he lived somewhere far away in Leytonstone, with a maiden sister 10 years older than himself, a fearsome virago twice his size, before whom he trembled. It was said she bullied him terribly in general, and in the particular instance of his spiritualistic leanings she had her own views. These leanings were to her simply satanic. She was reported as having declared that, with God's help, she would prevent that fool from giving himself up to the devils. It was beyond doubt that John's secret ambition was to get into personal communication with the spirits of the dead, if only his sister would let him. But she was adamant. I was told that while in London he had to account to her for every penny of the money he took with him in the morning, and for every hour of his time, and she kept the bank book too. Bunter, he had been a wild youngster, but he was well connected, had ancestors, there was a family tomb somewhere in the home counties. Bunter was indignant, perhaps on account of his own dead. Those steely blue eyes of his flashed with positive ferocity out of that black-bearded face. He impressed me. There was so much dark passion in his leisurely contempt. The cheek of the fellow! Enter into relations with a mean little cad like this! It would be an impudent intrusion. He wants to enter! What is it? A new sort of snobbishness or what? I laughed outright at this original view of spiritism, or whatever the ghost craze is called. Even Bunter himself condescended to smile, but it was an austere, quickly vanished smile. A man in his almost, I may say, tragic position couldn't be expected, you understand? He was really worried. He was ready eventually to put up with any dirty trick in the course of the voyage. A man could not expect much consideration should he find himself at the mercy of a fellow like John's. A misfortune is a misfortune, and there's an end of it. But to be bored by mean, low-spirited, inane ghost stories in the John style all the way out to Calcutta and back again was an intolerable apprehension to be under. Spiritism was indeed a solemn subject to think about in that light, dreadful even. Poor fellow. Little we both thought that before very long he himself. However, I could give him no comfort. I was rather appalled myself. Butler had also another annoyance that day. A confounded berthing master came on board on some pretense or other, but in reality, Bunter thought, simply impelled by an inconvenient curiosity, inconvenient to Bunter, that is. After some beating about the bush, that man suddenly said, "I can't help thinking I've seen you before somewhere, Mr. Mate. Have I heard your name, perhaps, Bunter?" That's the worst of a life with a mystery in it. He was much alarmed. It was very likely that the man had seen him before, worse luck to his excellent memory. Bunter himself could not be expected to remember every casual dock walloper he might have had to do with. Bunter brazened it out by turning upon the man, making use of that impressive black-as-night sternness of expression his unusual hair furnished him with. "My name's Bunter, sir. Does that enlighten your inquisitive intellect? And I don't ask what your name may be. I don't want to know. I've no use for it, sir. An individual who calmly tells me to his face that he is not sure if he has seen me before either means to be impudent or is no better than a worm, sir." "Yes," I said, "a worm, a blind worm." Brave Bunter. That was the line to take. He fairly drove the beggar out of the ship as if every word had been a blow. But the pertinacity of that brass-bound Paul Pry was astonishing. He cleared out of the ship, of course, before Bunter's ire, not saying anything, and only trying to cover up his retreat by a sickly smile. But once on the jetty, he turned deliberately round and set himself to stare in dead earnest at the ship. He remained planted there like a mooring post, absolutely motionless, and with his stupid eyes winking no more than a pair of cabin portholes. What could Bunter do? It was awkward for him, you know. He could not go and put his head into the bread locker. What he did was to take up a position abaft the mizzen rigging and stare back as unwinking as the other. So they remained, and I don't know which of them grew giddy first, but the man on the jetty, not having the advantage of something to hold on to, got tired the soonest, flung his arm, giving the contest up, as it were, and went away at last. Bunter told me he was glad the Sapphire, that gem amongst ships, as he alluded to her sarcastically, was going to sea next day. He had had enough of the dock. I understood his impatience. He had steeled himself against any possible worry the voyage might bring, though it is clear enough now that he was not prepared for the extraordinary experience that was awaiting him already, and in no other part of the world than the Indian Ocean itself, the very part of the world where the poor fellow had lost his ship and had broken his luck, as it seemed, for good and all, at the same time. As to his remorse in regard to a certain secret action of his life, well, I understand that a man of Bunter's fine character would suffer not a little. Still, between ourselves, and without the slightest wish to be cynical, it cannot be denied that with the noblest of us the fear of being found out enters for some considerable part into the composition of remorse. I didn't say this in so many words to Bunter, but, as the poor fellow harped a bit on it, I told him that there were skeletons in a good many honest cupboards, and that, as to his own particular guilt, it wasn't writ large on his face for everybody to see, so he needn't worry as to that. And besides, he would be gone to sea in about 12 hours from now. He said there was some comfort in that thought, and went off then to spend the last evening for many months with his wife. For all his wildness, Bunter had made no mistake in his marrying. He had married a lady, a perfect lady. She was a dear little woman, too. As to her pluck, I who know what times they had to go through, I cannot admire her enough for it. Real hard-wearing, every day and day after day pluck that only a woman is capable of when she is of the right sort. The undismayed sort, I would call it. The black mate felt this parting with his wife more than any of the previous ones in all the years of bad luck. But she was of the undismayed kind, and showed less trouble in her gentle face than the black-haired, buccaneer-like, but dignified mate of the Sapphire. It may be that her conscience was less disturbed than her husband's. Of course, his life had no secret places for her, but a woman's conscience is somewhat more resourceful in finding good and valid excuses. It depends greatly on the person that needs them, too. They had agreed that she should not come down to the dock to see him off. "I wonder you care to look at me at all," said the sensitive man, and she did not laugh. Bunter was very sensitive. He left her rather brusquely at the last. He got on board in good time and produced the usual impression on the mud pilot in the broken-down straw hat who took the Sapphire out of dock. The riverman was very polite to the dignified, striking-looking chief mate. "The 5-inch manilla for the check-rope, Mr. Bunter, thank you. Mr. Bunter, please." The sea-pilot, who left the gem of ships heading comfortably down channel off Dover, told some of his friends that this voyage the Sapphire had for chief mate a man who seemed a jolly sight too good for old John's. "Bunter's his name. I wonder where he's sprung from. Never seen him before in any ship I've piloted in or out all these years. He's the sort of man you don't forget. You couldn't. A thorough good sailor, too. And won't old John's just worry his head off, unless the old fool should take fright at him, for he does not seem the sort of man that would let himself be put upon without letting you know what he thinks of you. And that's exactly what old John's would be more afraid of than anything else." As this is really meant to be the record of a spiritualistic experience which came, if not precisely to Captain Johns himself, at any rate to his ship, there is no use in recording the other events of the passage out. It was an ordinary passage. The crew was an ordinary crew. The weather was of the usual kind. The black mate's quiet, sedate method of going to work had given a sober tone to the life of the ship. Even in gales of wind, everything went on quietly somehow. There was only one severe blow which made things fairly lively for all hands for full 24 hours. That was off the coast of Africa, after passing the Cape of Good Hope. At the very height of it, several heavy seas were shipped with no serious results, but there was a considerable smashing of breakable objects in the pantry and in the staterooms. Mr. Bunter, who was so greatly respected on board, found himself treated scurvily by the Southern Ocean, which, bursting open the door of his room like a ruffianly burglar, carried off several useful things, and made all the others extremely wet. Later, on the same day, the Southern Ocean caused the Sapphire to lurch over in such an unrestrained fashion that the two drawers fitted under Mr. Bunter's sleeping berth flew out altogether, spilling all their contents. They ought, of course, to have been locked, and Mr. Bunter had only to thank himself for what had happened. He ought to have turned the key on each before going out on deck. His consternation was very great. The steward, who was paddling about all the time with swabs, trying to dry out the flooded cuddy, heard him exclaim, "Hullo!" in a startled and dismayed tone. In the midst of his work, the steward felt a sympathetic concern for the mate's distress. Captain Johns was secretly glad when he heard of the damage. He was, indeed, afraid of his chief mate, as the sea pilot had ventured to foretell, and afraid of him for the very reason the sea pilot had put forward as likely. Captain Johns, therefore, would have liked very much to hold that black mate of his at his mercy in some way or other. But the man was irreproachable, as near absolute perfection as could be, and Captain Johns was very much annoyed, and at the same time congratulated himself on his chief officer's efficiency. He made a great show of living sociably with him, on the principle that the more friendly you are with a man, the more easily you may catch him tripping, and also for the reason that he wanted to have somebody who would listen to his stories of manifestations, apparitions, ghosts, and all the rest of the imbecile spook lore. He had it all at his fingers' ends, and he spun these ghostly yarns in a persistent, colourless voice, giving them a futile turn, peculiarly his own. "I like to converse with my officers," he used to say. "There are masters that hardly ever open their mouths from beginning to end of a passage for fear of losing their dignity. What's that, after all, this bitter position a man holds?" His sociability was most to be dreaded in the second dog watch, because he was one of those men who grow lively towards the evening, and the officer on duty was unable then to find excuses for leaving the poop. Captain Johns would pop up the companion suddenly, and sidling up in his creeping way to poor Bunter as he walked up and down, would fire into him some spiritualistic proposition, such as, "Spirits, male and female, show a good deal of refinement in a general way, don't they?" To which Bunter, holding his black-whiskered head high, would mutter, "I don't know." "Ah, that's because you don't want to. You're the most obstinate, prejudiced man I've ever met, Mr. Bunter. I told you, you may have any book out of my bookcase. You may just go into my stateroom and help yourself to any volume." And if Bunter protested that he was too tired in his watches below to spare any time for reading, Captain Johns would smile nastily behind his back and remark that, of course, some people needed more sleep than others to keep themselves fit for their work. If Mr. Bunter was afraid of not keeping properly awake when on duty at night, that was another matter. "But I think you borrowed a novel to read from the second mate the other day. A trashy pack of lies," Captain John sighed. "I'm afraid you're not a spiritually minded man, Mr. Bunter. That's what's the matter." Sometimes he would appear on deck in the middle of the night, looking very grotesque and bandy-legged in his sleeping suit. At that sight, the persecuted Bunter would wring his hands stealthily and break out into moisture all over his forehead. After standing sleepily by the binnacle, scratching himself in an unpleasant manner, Captain Johns was sure to start on some aspect or other of his only topic. He would, for instance, discourse on the improvement of morality to be expected from the establishment of general and close intercourse with the spirits of the departed. The spirits, Captain Johns thought, would consent to associate familiarly with the living if it were not for the unbelief of the great mass of mankind. He himself would not care to have anything to do with a crowd that would not believe in his, Captain John's, existence. Then why should a spirit? This was asking too much. He went on breathing hard by the binnacle and trying to reach round his shoulder blades. Then, with a thick, drowsy severity, declared, "Incredulity, sir, is the evil of the age. It rejected the evidence of Professor Cranks and of the journalist chap. It resisted the production of photographs." For Captain Johns believed firmly that certain spirits had been photographed. He had read something of it in the papers, and the idea of it having been done had got a tremendous hold on him, because his mind was not critical. Bunter said afterwards that nothing could be more weird than this little man, swathed in a sleeping suit three sizes too large for him, shuffling with excitement in the moonlight near the wheel and shaking his fist at the serene sea. "Photographs! Photographs!" he would repeat, in a voice as creaky as a rusty hinge. The very helmsman just behind him got uneasy at that performance, not being capable of understanding exactly what the old man was kicking up a row with the mate about. Then Johns, after calming down a bit, would begin again. The sensitized plate can't lie. No, sir. Nothing could be more funny than this ridiculous little man's convictions, his dogmatic tone. Bunter would go on swinging up and down the poop like a deliberate, dignified pendulum. He said not a word. But the poor fellow had not a trifle on his conscience, as you know, and to have imbecile ghosts ram down his throat like this on top of his own worry nearly drove him crazy. He knew that on many occasions he was on the verge of lunacy, because he could not help indulging in half-delirious visions of Captain John's being picked up by the scruff of the neck and dropped over the taffrail into the ship's wake, the sort of thing no sane sailorman would think of doing to a cat, or any other animal, anyhow. He imagined him bobbing up, a tiny black speck left far astern on the moonlit ocean. I don't think that even at the worst moments Bunter really desired to drown Captain John's. I fancy that all his disordered imagination longed for was merely to stop the ghostly inanity of the skipper's talk. But, all the same, it was a dangerous form of self-indulgence. Just picture to yourself that ship in the Indian Ocean, on a clear tropical night, with her sails full and still, the watch on deck stowed away out of sight, and on her poop, flooded with moonlight, the stately black mate walking up and down with measured, dignified steps, preserving an awful silence, and that grotesquely mean little figure in striped flannelette alternately creaking and droning of personal intercourse beyond the grave. It makes me creepy all over to think of. And sometimes the folly of Captain John's would appear clothed in a sort of weird utilitarianism. How useful it would be if the spirits of the departed could be induced to take a practical interest in the affairs of the living. What a help, say, to the police, for instance, in the detection of crime. The number of murders, at any rate, would be considerably reduced, he guessed with an air of great sagacity. Then he would give way to grotesque discouragement. Where was the use of trying to communicate with people that had no faith and more likely than not would scorn the offered information? Spirits had their feelings. They were all feelings in a way. But he was surprised at the forbearance shown towards murderers by their victims. That was the sort of apparition that no guilty man would dare to pooh-pooh. And perhaps the undiscovered murderers, whether believing or not, were haunted. They wouldn't be likely to boast about it, would they? For myself, he pursued in a sort of vindictive, malevolent whine, if anybody murdered me, I would not let him forget it. I would wither him up. I would terrify him to death. The idea of his skipper's ghost terrifying anyone was so ludicrous that the black mate, little disposed to mirth as he was, could not help giving vent to a weary laugh. And this laugh, the only acknowledgment of a long and earnest discourse, offended Captain John's. "What's there to laugh at in this conceited manner, Mr. Bunter?" he snarled. "Supernatural visitations have terrified better men than you. Don't you allow me enough soul to make a ghost of?" I think it was the nasty tone that caused Bunter to stop short and turn about. "I shouldn't wonder," went on the angry fanatic of spiritism, "if you weren't one of them people that take no more account of a man than if he were a beast. You would be capable, I don't doubt, to deny the possession of an immortal soul to your own father." And then Bunter, being bored beyond endurance and also exasperated by the private worry, lost his self-possession. He walked up suddenly to Captain John's, and stooping a little to look close into his face, said in a low, even tone, "You don't know what a man like me is capable of." Captain John's threw his head back, but was too astonished to budge. Bunter resumed his walk, and for a long time his measured footstep and the low wash of the water alongside were the only sounds which troubled the silence brooding over the great waters. Then Captain John's cleared his throat uneasily, and after sidling away towards the companion for greater safety, plucked up enough courage to retreat under an act of authority. "Raise the starboard clew of the mainsail and lay the yards dead square, Mr. Bunter. Don't you see the wind is nearly right aft?" Bunter at once answered, "Aye, aye, sir," though there was not the slightest necessity to touch the yards, and the wind was well out on the quarter. While he was executing the order, Captain John's hung on the companion steps, growling to himself, "Walk this poop like an admiral, and don't even notice when the yards want trimming," loud enough for the helmsman to overhear. Then he sank slowly backwards out of the man's sight, and when he reached the bottom of the stairs he stood still and thought, He's an awful ruffian with all his gentlemanly airs. No more gentleman mates for me. Two nights afterwards he was slumbering peacefully in his berth when a heavy thumping just above his head, a well-understood signal that he was wanted on deck, made him leap out of bed, broad awake in a moment. "What's up?" he muttered, running out barefooted. On passing through the cabin he glanced at the clock. It was the middle watch. "What on earth can the mate want me for?" he thought. Bolting out of the companion, he found a clear, dewy, moonlit night and a strong, steady breeze. He looked around wildly. There was no one on the poop except the helmsman, who addressed him at once. "It was me, sir. I let go the wheel for a second to stamp over your head. I'm afraid there's something wrong with the mate." "Where's he got to?" asked the captain sharply. The man, who was obviously nervous, said, "The last I saw of him was as he fell down the port poop ladder." "Fell down the poop ladder? What did he do that for? What made him?" "I don't know, sir. He was walking the port side. Then, just as he turned towards me to come aft..." "You saw him?" interrupted the captain. "I did. I was looking at him. And I heard the crash, too. Something awful, like the mainmast going overboard. It was as if something had struck him." Captain Johns became very uneasy and alarmed. "Come," he said sharply, "did anybody strike him? What did you see?" "Nothing, sir, so help me. There was nothing to see. He just gave a little sort of hallo, threw his hands before him, and over he went, crash. I couldn't hear anything more, so I just let go the wheel for a second to call you up." "You're scared," said Captain Johns.
"I am, sir, straight."
Captain Johns stared at him. The silence of his ship driving on her way seemed to contain a danger, a mystery. He was reluctant to go and look for his mate himself in the shadows of the main deck, so quiet, so still. All he did was to advance to the break of the poop and call for the watch. As the sleepy men came trooping aft, he shouted to them fiercely, "Look at the foot of the port poop ladder, some of you. See the mate lying there?" Their startled exclamations told him immediately that they did see him. Somebody even screeched out emotionally, "He's dead!" Mr. Bunter was laid in his bunk, and when the lamp in his room was lit, he looked indeed as if he were dead, but it was obvious also that he was breathing yet. The steward had been roused out, the second mate called and sent on deck to look after the ship, and for an hour or so Captain Johns devoted himself silently to the restoring of consciousness. Mr. Bunter at last opened his eyes, but he could not speak. He was dazed and inert. The steward bandaged a nasty scalp wound while Captain Johns held an additional light. They had to cut away a lot of Mr. Bunter's jet-black hair to make a good dressing. This done, and after gazing for a while at their patient, the two left the cabin.
"A rum go, this, steward," said Captain Johns in the passage.
"Yes, sir."
"A sober man that's right in his head does not fall down a poop ladder like a sack of potatoes. The ship's as steady as a church."
"Yes, sir. Fit of some kind, I shouldn't wonder."
"Well, I should. He doesn't look as if he was subject to fits and giddiness. Why, the man's in the prime of his life. I wouldn't have had another kind of mate, not if I knew it. You don't think he has a private store of liquor, do you, eh? He seemed to me a bit strange in his manner several times lately. Off his feed, too, a bit, I noticed."
"Well, sir, if he ever had a bottle or two of grog in his cabin, that must have gone a long time ago. I saw him throw some broken glass overboard after the last gale we had, but that didn't amount to anything. Anyway, sir, you couldn't call Mr. Bunter a drinking man."
"No," conceded the captain reflectively.
And the steward, locking the pantry door, tried to escape out of the passage, thinking he could manage to snatch another hour of sleep before it was time for him to turn out for the day. Captain John shook his head.
"There's some mystery there.
There's special providence that he didn't crack his head like an eggshell on the quarter-deck mooring bit, sir. The men tell me he couldn't have missed them by more than an inch."
And the steward vanished skilfully. Captain John spent the rest of the night and the whole of the ensuing day between his own room and that of the mate. In his own room he sat with his open hands reposing on his knees, his lips pursed up, and the horizontal furrows on his forehead marked very heavily. Now and then, raising his arm by a slow, as if cautious, movement, he scratched lightly the top of his bald head.
In the mate's room he stood for long periods of time with his hand to his lips, gazing at the half-conscious man. For 3 days Mr. Bunter did not say a single word. He looked at people sensibly enough, but did not seem able to hear any questions put to him. They cut off some more of his hair and swathed his head in wet cloths. He took some nourishment and was made as comfortable as possible. At dinner, on the 3rd day, the second mate remarked to the captain in connection with the affair, "These half-round brass plates on the steps of poop ladders are beastly dangerous things."
"Are they?" retorted Captain John sourly. "It takes more than a brass plate to account for an able-bodied man crashing down in this fashion like a felled ox."
The second mate was impressed by that view. There was something in that, he thought.
"And the weather fine, everything dry, and the ship going along as steady as a church," pursued Captain Johns gruffly.
As Captain Johns continued to look extremely sour, the second mate did not open his lips any more during the dinner. Captain Johns was annoyed and hurt by an innocent remark, because the fitting of the aforesaid brass plates had been done at his suggestion only the voyage before, in order to smarten up the appearance of the poop ladders. On the 4th day Mr. Bunter looked decidedly better, very languid yet, of course, but he heard and understood what was said to him, and even could say a few words in a feeble voice. Captain Johns, coming in, contemplated him attentively, without much visible sympathy.
"Well, can you give us an account of this accident, Mr. Bunter?"
Bunter moved slightly his bandaged head and fixed his cold blue stare on Captain John's face, as if taking stock and appraising the value of every feature, the perplexed forehead, the credulous eyes, the inane droop of the mouth. And he gazed so long that Captain John's grew restive and looked over his shoulder at the door.
"No accident," breathed out Bunter in a peculiar tone. "You don't mean to say you've got the falling sickness," said Captain Johns. "How would you call it signing as chief mate of a clipper ship with a thing like that on you?"
Bunter answered him only by a sinister look. The skipper shuffled his feet a little.
"Well, what made you have that tumble, then?"
Bunter raised himself a little, and looking straight into Captain Johns' eyes, said, in a very distinct whisper,
"You were right."
He fell back and closed his eyes. Not a word more could Captain Johns get out of him, and the steward coming into the cabin, the skipper withdrew. But that very night, unobserved, Captain Johns, opening the door cautiously, entered again the mate's cabin. He could wait no longer. The suppressed eagerness, the excitement expressed in all his mean, creeping little person, did not escape the chief mate, who was lying awake, looking frightfully pulled down and perfectly impassive.
"You're coming to gloat over me, I suppose," said Bunter, without moving, and yet making a palpable hit.
"Bless my soul!" exclaimed Captain Johns with a start, and assuming a sobered demeanour. "There's a thing to say!"
"Well, gloat, then. You and your ghosts, you've managed to get over a live man."
This was said by Bunter without stirring, in a low voice, and with not much expression.
"Do you mean to say," inquired Captain Johns in awe-struck whisper, "that you had a supernatural experience that night? You saw an apparition, then, on board my ship?"
Reluctance, shame, disgust would have been visible on poor Bunter's countenance if the great part of it had not been swathed up in cotton wool and bandages. His ebony eyebrows, more sinister than ever amongst all that lot of white linen, came together in a frown as he made a mighty effort to say,
"Yes, I have seen."
The wretchedness in his eyes would have awakened the compassion of any other man than Captain Johns. But Captain Johns was all agog with triumphant excitement. He was just a little bit frightened, too. He looked at that unbelieving scoffer laid low, and did not even dimly guess at his profound, humiliating distress. He was not generally capable of taking much part in the anguish of his fellow creatures. This time, moreover, he was excessively anxious to know what had happened. Fixing his credulous eyes on the bandaged head, he asked, trembling slightly,
"And did it knock you down?"
"Come, am I the sort of man to be knocked down by a ghost?" protested Bunter in a little stronger tone. "Don't you remember what you said yourself the other night? Better men than me?"
"Ah, You'll have to look a long time before you find a better man for a mate of your ship."
Captain Johns pointed a solemn finger at Bunter's bedplace. "You've been terrified," he said. "That's what's the matter. You've been terrified." Why, even the man at the wheel was scared, though he couldn't see anything. He felt the supernatural. "You are punished for your incredulity, Mr. Bunter. You were terrified."
"And suppose I was," said Bunter. "Do you know what I have seen? Can you conceive the sort of ghost that would haunt a man like me? Do you think it was a ladyish afternoon call, another cup of tea, please, apparition that visits your Professor Cranks and that journalist chap you're always talking about? No, I can tell you what it was like. Every man has his own ghosts. You couldn't conceive."
Bunter stopped out of breath, and Captain Johns remarked, with the glow of inward satisfaction reflected in his tone,
"I've always thought that you were the sort of man that was ready for anything, from pitch and toss to wilful murder, as the saying goes. Well, well, so you were terrified."
"I stepped back," said Bunter curtly. "I don't remember anything else."
"The man at the wheel told me you went backwards as if something had hit you."
"It was a sort of inward blow," explained Bunter. "Something too deep for you, Captain Johns, to understand. Your life and mine haven't been the same. Aren't you satisfied to see me converted?"
"And you can't tell me any more?" asked Captain Johns anxiously.
"No, I can't. I wouldn't. It would be no use if I did. That sort of experience must be gone through. Say I am being punished. Well, I take my punishment, but talk of it I won't."
"Very well," said Captain Johns, "you won't. But mind, I can draw my conclusions from that."
"Draw what you like, but be careful what you say, sir. You don't terrify me. You aren't a ghost."
"One word. Has it any connection with what you said to me on that last night when we had a talk together on spiritualism?"
Bunter looked weary and puzzled. "What did I say?"
"You told me that I couldn't know what a man like you was capable of."
"Yes, yes. Enough."
"Very good. I am fixed, then," remarked Captain Johns. "All I say is that I am jolly glad not to be you, though I would have given almost anything for the privilege of personal communication with the world of spirits."
"Yes, sir, but not in that way." Poor Bunter moaned pitifully. "It has made me feel 20 years older." Captain Johns retired quietly. He was delighted to observe this overbearing ruffian humbled to the dust by the moralizing agency of the spirits. The whole occurrence was a source of pride and gratification, and he began to feel a sort of regard for his chief mate. It is true that in further interviews Bunter showed himself very mild and deferential. He seemed to cling to his captain for spiritual protection. He used to send for him and say, "I feel so nervous," and Captain Johns would stay patiently for hours in the hot little cabin and feel proud of the call. For Mr. Bunter was ill and could not leave his berth for a good many days. He became a convinced spiritualist, not enthusiastically, that could hardly have been expected from him, but in a grim, unshakable way. He could not be called exactly friendly to the disembodied habitants of our globe as Captain Johns was, but he was now a firm, if gloomy, recruit of spiritualism. One afternoon, as the ship was already well to the north of the Gulf of Bengal, the steward knocked at the door of the captain's cabin and said, without opening it, "The mate asks if you could spare him a moment, sir. He seems to be in a state in there." Captain Johns jumped up from the couch at once. "Yes, tell him I'm coming." He thought, could it be possible there had been another spiritual manifestation, in the daytime, too? He revelled in the hope. It was not exactly that, however. Still, Bunter, whom he saw sitting collapsed in a chair, he had been up for several days, but not on deck as yet, poor Bunter had something startling enough to communicate. His hands covered his face. His legs were stretched straight out, dismally. "What's the news now?" croaked Captain Johns, not unkindly, because in truth it always pleased him to see Bunter, as he expressed it, tamed.
"News!" exclaimed the crushed sceptic through his hands. "Aye, news enough, Captain Johns. Who will be able to deny the awfulness, the genuineness? Another man would have dropped dead. You want to know what I had seen? All I can tell you is that since I've seen it, my hair is turning white.
Bunder detached his hands from his face, and they hung on each side of his chair as if dead. He looked broken in the dusky cabin.
You don't say, stammered out Captain Johns. Turned white? Hold on a bit, I'll light the lamp.
When the lamp was lit, the startling phenomenon could be seen plain enough, as if the dread, the horror, the anguish of the supernatural were being exhaled through the pores of his skin. A sort of silvery mist seemed to cling to the cheeks and the head of the mate. His short beard, his cropped hair, were growing, not black, but grey, almost white. When Mr. Bunter, thin-faced and shaky, came on deck for duty, he was clean-shaven, and his head was white. The hands were awestruck. Another man, they whispered to each other. It was generally and mysteriously agreed that the mate had seen something, with the exception of the man at the wheel at the time, who maintained that the mate was struck by something. This distinction hardly amounted to a difference. On the other hand, everybody admitted that, after he picked up his strength a bit, he seemed even smarter in his movements than before. One day, in Calcutta, Captain Johns, pointing out to a visitor his white-headed chief mate standing by the main hatch, was heard to say oracularly, "That man's in the prime of life." Of course, while Bunter was away, I called regularly on Mrs. Bunter every Saturday, just to see whether she had any use for my services. It was understood I would do that. She had just his half-pay to live on. It amounted to about £1 a week. She had taken one room in a quiet little square in the East End. And this was affluence to what I had heard that the couple were reduced to for a time after Bunter had to give up the Western Ocean trade. He used to go as mate of all sorts of hard packets after he lost his ship and his luck together. It was affluence at that time when Bunter would start at 7 o'clock in the morning with but a glass of hot water and a crust of dry bread. It won't stand thinking about, especially for those who know Mrs. Bunter. I had seen something of them too at that time, and it just makes me shudder to remember what that born lady had to put up with. Enough. Dear Mrs. Bunter used to worry a good deal after the Sapphire left for Calcutta. She would say to me, "It must be so awful for poor Winston." Winston is Bunter's name, and I tried to comfort her the best I could. Afterwards she got some small children to teach in a family and was half the day with them, and the occupation was good for her. In the very first letter she had from Calcutta, Bunter told her he had had a fall down the poop ladder and cut his head, but no bones broken, thank God. And that was all. Of course she had other letters from him, but that vagabond Bunter never gave me a scratch of the pen the solid 11 months. I supposed, naturally, that everything was going on all right. Who could imagine what was happening? Then, one day, dear Mrs. Bunter got a letter from a legal firm in the city, advising her that her uncle was dead, her old curmudgeon of an uncle, a retired stockbroker, a heartless, petrified antiquity that had lasted on and on. He was nearly 90, I believe, and if I were to meet his venerable ghost this minute, I would try to take him by the throat and strangle him. The old beast would never forgive his niece for marrying Bunter, and years afterwards, when people made a point of letting him know that she was in London, pretty nearly starving at 40 years of age, he only said, "Serve the little fool right." I believe he meant her to starve. And lo and behold, the old cannibal died intestate, with no other relatives but that very identical little fool. The Bunters were wealthy people now. Of course, Mrs. Bunter wept as if her heart would break. In any other woman it would have been mere hypocrisy. Naturally, too, she wanted to cable the news to her Winston in Calcutta, but I showed her, gazette in hand, that the ship was on the homeward-bound list for more than a week already. So we sat down to wait, and talked, meantime, of dear old Winston every day. There were just 100 such days before the Sapphire got reported all well in the chops of the Channel by an incoming mail-boat. "I'm going to Dunkirk to meet him," says she. The Sapphire had a cargo of jute for Dunkirk. Of course, I had to escort the dear lady in the quality of her ingenious friend. She calls me our ingenious friend to this day,
and I've observed some people, strangers, looking hard at me for the signs of the ingenuity, I suppose. After settling Mrs. Bunter in a good hotel in Dunkirk, I walked down to the docks, late afternoon it was, and what was my surprise to see the ship actually fast alongside. Either Johns or Bunter or both must have been driving her hard up channel. Anyway, she had been in since the day before last, and her crew was already paid off. I met two of her apprenticed boys going off home on leave with their dunnage on a Frenchman's barrow, as happy as larks, and I asked them if the mate was on board. "There he is, on the quay, looking at the moorings," says one of the youngsters as he skipped past me. You may imagine the shock to my feelings when I beheld his white head. I could only manage to tell him that his wife was at an hotel in town. He left me at once to go and get his hat on board. I was mightily surprised by the smartness of his movements as he hurried up the gangway. Whereas the black mate struck people as deliberate and strangely stately in his gait for a man in the prime of life, this white-headed chap seemed the most wonderfully alert of old men. I don't suppose Bunter was any quicker on his pins than before. It was the colour of the hair that made all the difference in one's judgment. The same with the eyes. Those eyes that looked at you so steely, so fierce, and so fascinating out of a bush of a buccaneer's black hair, now had an innocent, almost boyish expression in their good-humoured brightness under those white eyebrows. I led him without any delay into Mrs. Bunter's private sitting-room. After she had dropped a tear over the late cannibal, given a hug to her Winston, and told him that he must grow his moustache again, the dear lady tucked her feet upon the sofa, and I got out of Bunter's way. He started at once to pace the room, waving his long arms. He worked himself into a regular frenzy and tore Johns limb from limb many times over that evening. "Fell down? Of course I fell down, by slipping backwards on that fool's patent brass plates. Upon my word, I'd been walking that poop in charge of the ship, and I didn't know whether I was in the Indian Ocean or in the moon. I was crazy. My head spun round and round with sheer worry. I had made my last application of your chemist's wonderful stuff. This, to me. All the store of bottles you gave me got smashed when those drawers fell out in the last gale. I had been getting some dry things to change when I heard the cry, 'All hands on deck,' and made one jump of it without even pushing them in properly. Ass! When I came back and saw the broken glass and the mess, I felt ready to faint. No, look here. Deception is bad, but not to be able to keep it up after one has been forced into it. You know that since I've been squeezed out of the Western Ocean packets by younger men, just on account of my grizzled muzzle, you know how much chance I had to ever get a ship, and not a soul to turn to. We've been a lonely couple, we two. She threw away everything for me, and to see her want a piece of dry bread." He banged with his fist, fit to split the Frenchman's table in two. I would have turned into a sanguinary pirate for her, let alone cheating my way into a berth by dyeing my hair. So when you came to me with your chemist's wonderful stuff—" He checked himself. "By the way, that fellow's got a fortune when he likes to pick it up. It is a wonderful stuff. You tell him salt water can do nothing to it. It stays on as long as your hair will." "All right," I said, "go on." Thereupon he went for Johns again with a fury that frightened his wife and made me laugh till I cried. Just you try to think what it would have meant to be at the mercy of the meanest creature that ever commanded a ship. Just fancy what a life that crawling Johns would have led me. And I knew that in a week or so the white hair would begin to show. And the crew, did you ever think of that? To be shown up as a low fraud before all hands? What a life for me till we got to Calcutta. And once there, kicked out, of course, half pay stopped. Annie here, alone without a penny, starving, and I on the other side of the earth, ditto. You see? I thought of shaving twice a day, but could I shave my head too? No way, no way at all, unless I dropped Johns overboard, and even then. Do you wonder now that with all these things boiling in my head I didn't know where I was putting my foot that night? I just felt myself falling, then crash, and all dark. When I came to myself, that bang on the head seemed to have steadied my wit somehow. I was so sick of everything that for 2 days I wouldn't speak to anyone. They thought it was a slight concussion of the brain. Then the idea dawned upon me as I was looking at that ghost-ridden, wretched fool. "Ah, you love ghosts," I thought. "Well, you shall have something from beyond the grave." I didn't even trouble to invent a story. I couldn't imagine a ghost if I wanted to. I wasn't fit to lie connectedly if I had tried. I just bullied him on to it. Do you know, he got, quite by himself, a notion that at some time or other I had done somebody to death in some way, and that... "Oh, the horrible man," cried Mrs. Bunter from the sofa. There was silence. "And didn't he bore my head off on the home passage?" began Bunter again in a weary voice. "He loved me. He was proud of me. I was converted. I had had a manifestation. Do you know what he was after? He wanted me and him to make a seance, in his own words, and to try to call up that ghost, the one that had turned my hair white, the ghost of my supposed victim, and, as he said, talk it over with him, the ghost, in a friendly way. Or else, Bunter, he says, you may get another manifestation when you least expect it, and tumble overboard, perhaps, or something. You ain't really safe till we pacify the spirit world in some way. Can you conceive a lunatic like that? No? Say." I said nothing, but Mrs. Bunter did, in a very decided tone. "Winston, I don't want you to go on board that ship again any more." "My dear," says he, "I have all my things on board yet." "You don't want the things. Don't go near that ship at all." He stood still, then, drooping his eyes with a faint smile, said slowly in a dreamy voice, "The haunted ship. And your last," I added. We carried him off as he stood by the night train. He was very quiet, but crossing the channel, as we two had a smoke on deck, he turned to me suddenly, and grinding his teeth, whispered, "He'll never know how near he was to being dropped overboard." He meant Captain Johns. I said nothing. But Captain Johns, I understand, made a great to-do about the disappearance of his chief mate. He set the French police scouring the country for the body. In the end, I fancy he got word from his owner's office to drop all the fuss. That was all right. I don't suppose he ever understood anything of that mysterious occurrence. To this day he tries at times. He's retired now, and his conversation is not very coherent. He tries to tell the story of a black mate he once had, a murderous, gentlemanly ruffian with raven-black hair which turned white all at once in consequence of a manifestation from beyond the grave. An avenging apparition. What with reference to black and white hair, to poop ladders, and to his own feelings and views, it is difficult to make head or tail of it. If his sister, she's very vigorous still, should be present, she cuts all this short, peremptorily. "Don't you mind what he says. He's got devils on the brain." End of The Black Mate, 1884. End of Tales of Hearsay by Joseph Conrad.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.